Chapter 59. I conquer the Gornergrat. We went into camp on that wild spot to which that ram had brought us. The men were greatly fatigued. Their conviction that we were lost was forgotten in the cheer of a good supper, and before the reaction had a chance to set in, I loaded them up with paregoric and put them to bed. Next morning I was considering in my mind our desperate situation and trying to think of a remedy, when Harris came to me with a Baedeker map which showed conclusively that the mountain we were on was still in Switzerland. Yes, every part of it was in Switzerland. So we were not lost, after all. This was an immense relief. It lifted the weight of two such mountains from my breast. I immediately had the news disseminated and the map was exhibited. The effect was wonderful. As soon as the men saw with their own eyes that they knew where they were, and that it was only the summit that was lost and not themselves, they cheered up instantly, and said with one accord, "Let the summit take care of itself." Our distresses being at an end, I now determined to rest the men in camp, and give the scientific department of the expedition a chance. First, I made a barometric observation to get our altitude, but I could not perceive that there was any result. I knew, by my scientific reading, that either thermometers or barometers ought to be boiled to make them accurate. I did not know which it was, so I boiled them both. There was still no result, so I examined these instruments and discovered that they possessed radical blemishes. The barometer had no hand, but the brass pointer and the ball of the thermometer was stuffed with tin foil. I might have boiled those things to rags and never found out anything. I hunted up another barometer. It was new and perfect. I boiled it half an hour in a pot of bean soup which the cooks were making. The result was unexpected. The instrument was not affecting at all, but there was such a strong barometer taste to the soup that the head cook, who was a most conscientious person, changed its name in the bill of fare. The dish was so greatly liked by all that I ordered the cook to have barometer soup every day. It was believed that the barometer might eventually be injured, but I did not care for that. I had demonstrated to my satisfaction that it could not tell how high a mountain was, therefore I had no real use for it. Changes in the weather I could take care of without it. I did not wish to know when the weather was going to be good. What I wanted to know was when it was going to be bad, and this I could find out from Harris's corns. Harris had his corns tested and regulated at the government observatory in Heidelberg, and one could depend upon them with confidence. So I transferred the new barometer to the cooking department, to be used for the official mess. It was found that even a pretty fair article of soup could be made from the defective barometer, so I allowed that one to be transferred to the subordinate mess. I next boiled the thermometer, and got a most excellent result. The mercury went up to about 200 degrees Fahrenheit. In the opinion of the other scientists of the expedition, this seemed to indicate that we had attained the extraordinary altitude of 200,000 feet above sea level. Science places the line of eternal snow at about 10,000 feet above sea level. There was no snow where we were. Consequently, it was proven that the eternal snow line ceases somewhere above the 10,000 foot level and does not begin anymore. This was an interesting fact, and one which had not been observed by any observer before. It was as valuable as interesting too, since it would open up the deserted summits of the highest Alps to population and agriculture. It was a proud thing to be where we were, yet it caused us a pang to reflect that, but for that ram we might just as well be 200,000 feet higher. The success of my last experiment induced me to try an experiment with my photographic apparatus. I got it out, and boiled one of my cameras, but the thing was a failure. It made the wood swell up and burst, and I could not see that the lenses were any better than they were before. I now concluded to boil a guide. It might improve him, it could not impair his usefulness. But I was not allowed to proceed. Guides have no feeling for science, and this one would not consent to be made uncomfortable in its interest. In the midst of my scientific work, one of those needless accidents happened which are always occurring among the ignorant and thoughtless. A porter shot at a chamois, and missed it, and crippled the Latinist. This was not a serious matter to me, for a Latinist's duties are as well performed on crutches as otherwise, but the fact remained that, if the Latinist had not happened to be in the way, a mule would have got that load. That would have been quite another matter, for when it comes down to a question of value, there is a palpable difference between a Latinist and a mule. I could not depend on having a Latinist in the right place every time, so, to make things safe, I ordered that in the future the chamois must not be hunted within limits of the camp with any other weapon than the forefinger. My nerves had hardly grown quiet after this affair, when they got another shake-up, one which utterly unmanned me for a moment. A rumor swept suddenly through the camp, that one of the barkeepers had fallen over a precipice. However, it turned out that it was only a chaplain. I had laid in an extra force of chaplains, purposely to be prepared for emergencies like this, but by some unaccountable oversight, had come away rather short-handed in the matter of barkeepers. On the following morning we moved on, well refreshed and in good spirits. I remember this day with peculiar pleasure, because it saw our road restored to us. Yes, we found our road again, and in quite an extraordinary way. We had plodded along some 2 hours and a half, when we came up against a solid mass of rock about 20 feet high. I did not need to be instructed by a mule this time. I was already beginning to know more than any mule in the expedition. I at once put in a blast of dynamite, and lifted that rock out of the way. But to my surprise and mortification, I found that there had been a chalet on top of it. I picked up such members of the family as fell in my vicinity, and subordinates of my corps collected the rest. None of these poor people were injured, happily, but they were much annoyed. I explained to the head chalet just how the thing happened, and that I was only searching for the road, and would certainly have given him timely notice if I had known he was up there. I said I had meant no harm, and hoped I had not lowered myself in his estimation, by raising him a few rods in the air. I said many other judicious things, and finally when I offered to rebuild his chalet, and pay for the breakages, and throw in the cellar, he was mollified and satisfied. He hadn't any cellar at all, before. He would not have as good a view, now, as formerly, but what he had lost in view he had gained in cellar, by exact measurement. He said there wasn't another hole like that in the mountains, and he would have been right if the late mule had not tried to eat up the nitroglycerin. I put 116 men at work, and they rebuilt the chalet from its own debris in 15 minutes. It was a good deal more picturesque than it was before, too. The man said we were now on the Fehlstutz, above the Schwegmatt information which I was glad to get, since it gave us our position to a degree of particularity which we had not been accustomed to for a day or so. We also learned that we were standing at the foot of the Riffelberg proper, and that the initial chapter of our work was completed. We had a fine view, from here, of the energetic Visp, as it makes its first plunge into the world from under a huge arch of solid ice, worn through the footwall of the Great Gorner Glacier, and we could also see the Fergenbach, which is the outlet of the Fergen Glacier. The mule rode to the summit of the Riffelberg passed right in front of the chalet, a circumstance which we almost immediately noticed, because a procession of tourists was filing along it pretty much all the time. 1. The chalet's business consisted in furnishing refreshments to tourists. My blast had interrupted this trade for a few minutes, by breaking all the bottles on the place, but I gave the man a lot of whiskey, to sell for Alpine champagne, and a lot of vinegar which would answer for Rhine wine. Consequently trade was soon as brisk as ever. 1. Ready much may not be elegant English, but it is high time it was. There is no elegant word or phrase which means just what it means. M. T. Leaving the expedition outside to rest, I quartered myself in the chalet with Harris, proposing to correct my journals and scientific observations before continuing the ascent. I had hardly begun my work when a tall, slender, vigorous American youth of about 23, who was on his way down the mountain, entered and came toward me with that brief self-complacency which is the adolescent's idea of the well-bred ease of the man of the world. His hair was short, and parted accurately in the middle, and he had all the look of an American person who would be likely to begin his signature with an initial, and spell his middle name out. He introduced himself, smiling a smirky smile borrowed from the courtiers of the stage, extended a fair-skinned talon, and while he gripped my hand in it, he bent his body forward three times at the hips, as the stage courtier does, and said in the airiest, and most condescending, and patronizing way I quite remember his exact language. "Very glad to make your acquaintance, I'm sure. Very glad indeed, assure you. I've read all your little efforts and greatly admired them, and when I heard you were here, I... I indicated a chair, and he sat down. This grandee was the grandson of an American of considerable note in his day, and not wholly forgotten, yet a man who came so near being a great man, that he was quite generally accounted one while he lived. I slowly paced the floor, pondering scientific problems, and heard this conversation. "Grandson. First visit to Europe? Harris. Mine? Yes. G. SS," with a soft reminiscent sigh suggestive of bygone joys that may be tasted in their freshness but once.
"Ah, I know what it is to you. A first visit. Ah, the romance of it. I wish I could feel it again. Yes, I find it exceeds all my dreams. It is enchantment. I go. G. SS,"
with a dainty gesture of the hand signifying, "Pair me your callow enthusiasms, good friend."
"Yes, I know, you go to cathedrals, and exclaim, and you drag through league-long picture galleries and exclaim, and you stand here, and there, and yonder, upon historic ground, and continue to exclaim, and you are permeated with your first crude conceptions of art, and are proud and happy. Ah, yes, proud and happy, that expresses it. Yes, yes, enjoy it, it is right, it is an innocent revel."
H. "And you? Don't you do these things now?"
G. SS. I. Oh, that is very good. My dear sir, when you are as old a traveler as I am, you will not ask such a question as that. I visit the regulation gallery, moon around the regulation cathedral, do the worn round of the regulation sites, yet?
Excuse me.
H. Well, what do you do, then?
G. SS. Do? I flit and flit, for I am ever on the wing, but I avoid the herd. Today I am in Paris, tomorrow in Berlin, anon in Rome, but you would look for me in vain in the galleries of the Louvre, or the common resorts of the gazers in those other capitals. If you would find me, you must look in the unvisited nooks and corners, where others never think of going. One day you will find me making myself at home in some obscure peasant's cabin, another day you will find me in some forgotten castle worshipping some little gem or art which the careless eye has overlooked, and which the inexperienced would despise. Again you will find me as guest in the inner sanctuaries of palaces, while the herd is content to get a hurried glimpse of the unused chambers by feeing a servant. H. You are a guest in such places?
G. SS. And a welcoming one.
H. It is surprising. How does it come?
G. SS. My grandfather's name is a passport to all the courts in Europe. I have only to utter that name, and every door is open to me. I flit from court to court at my own free will and pleasure, and am always welcome. I am as much at home in the palaces of Europe as you are among your relatives. I know every titled person in Europe, I think. I have my pockets full of invitations all the time. I am under promise to go to Italy, where I am to be the guest of a succession of the noblest houses in the land. In Berlin my life is a continued round of gaiety in the Imperial Palace. It is the same, wherever I go. H. It must be very pleasant. But it must make Boston seem a little slow, when you are at home. G. SS yes, of course it does. But I don't go home much. There's no life there, little to feed a man's higher nature. Boston's very narrow, you know. She doesn't know it, and you couldn't convince her of it, so I say nothing when I'm there. Where's the use? Yes, Boston is very narrow, but she has such a good opinion of herself, that she can't see it. A man who has traveled as much as I have, and seen as much of the world, sees it plain enough, but he can't cure it, you know, so the best is to leave it, and seek a sphere which is more in harmony with his tastes and culture. I run across there, one a year, perhaps, when I have nothing important on hand, but I'm very soon back again. I spend my time in Europe. H.I.C. You map out your plans and... .. G. S.S. No, excuse me. I don't map out any plans. I simply follow the inclination of the day. I am limited by no ties, no requirements. I am not bound in any way. I am too old a traveler to hamper myself with deliberate purposes. I am simply a traveler, an inveterate traveler, a man of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.